You turn to the book of 1 Samuel, chapter 20. We're continuing on through our study in the life of David. And we are moving into a new chapter this month. It's been 2 months since our last study, and as a brief reminder of the events that have just immediately preceded this, of course, what's happening overall in the life of David is that he is continuing to grow in God's sovereign purpose for his life, which is that God has marked David out for a great purpose. And he's marked him out for the purpose of being the king of Israel. And everything that's happened in David's life up until this moment is part of the preparation phase of the Lord getting him ready for the fulfillment of his calling and the great purpose that the Lord has for him. And even all of the difficult circumstances of his life, and so far he's gone through several, are part of that preparation. Where we found David in the very last section that we studied was that he had fled from his home through the help of his wife, and that he fled from his own home because Saul had ordered his soldiers to go and surround David's home and lay in wait for him and to arrest him and to bring him to Saul with the purpose and the intention of killing David. And why does Saul want to kill David? What's going on with Saul, of course, is that Saul has moved into a progressively worse place with the Lord. His heart is moving further and further away from the Lord. Saul had at one point had some kind of real relationship with the Lord, certainly was called by the Lord into this role of being the king. But Saul had rebelled against the Lord. Saul had disobeyed the Lord in some critical issues that the Lord had given him some very specific instructions to obey. He had chosen to go another route. In that, the Lord judged him, the Lord disciplined him, and the Lord removed the blessing of his spirit from Saul. And ever since that time, Saul has kind of descended into kind of a spiritual insanity in which he has moments of clarity and he has moments where he seems normal and he seems fine. And then he has these fits that he goes into, these fits of rage, these fits of hatred toward David in particular. And he's focused his hatred on David for no logical reason, no good reason, other than the fact that David, he sees in David the kind of the potential of the loss of his own position as king. He sees that David is being raised up by the Lord, and he's consumed with this jealousy toward David and this desire to remove David from the equation. And so having fled from his house, David has fled specifically at the end of chapter 19 to someone that represents true spiritual security to him. He fled to the village, the town in which Samuel the prophet lived. Remember, Samuel played a key role both in the life of Saul and him becoming king, because Samuel is the one that had, by the Spirit of God, anointed Saul as king. And Samuel also played a similar role in David's life, in that he is already, even though David hasn't entered into this role yet, he has already anointed David as king, meaning that he has marked him out as the future king of Israel. And so when David reached his lowest point and the threat was the greatest, he fled his house and he fled where he should have gone, which was to the home, the house of Samuel. And while he was there, it wasn't that just because now he's at Samuel's house, the prophet of God, Saul has forgotten all of his desire to kill David. Saul actually pursues David at Samuel's house, and he sends three delegations of soldiers to arrest David. And all three of those delegations are in a sense, re-diverted by the Lord as they come with the intention of arresting David. And before they even get to David, they're overwhelmed by the Spirit of God and they begin to prophesy. And then Saul himself finally decides he's going to come in person. And so he comes, and before he even gets there, Saul is overwhelmed by the Spirit of God and he begins to prophesy. Not only prophesy, but remember, at the end of the chapter, he actually stripped himself naked, which was a work of the Spirit of God in Saul to prophetically display where Saul was heading, which is stripped of all of the blessings of the kingdom, which is the judgment of God upon his life. So let's look at the very last verse again, verse of chapter 19 before we read into chapter 20. It says, speaking of Saul, he also stripped off his clothes, and he too prophesied before Samuel and lay down naked all that day and all that night. Therefore, they say, is Saul also among the prophets? Now, that's where chapter 19 ends, which is the scene that's leading into chapter 20 is simply that David is in the background hiding out or secure in Samuel's house in Ramah. And Samuel is in charge of the circumstance, spiritually speaking. And above and beyond Samuel, of course, the Lord is in control of the circumstance. Saul is there, but Saul is not in charge, and Saul is not in control. He's so much out of control that he's laying on the ground, stripped naked and prophesying, completely under the hand of God. And then we have an unusual beginning of the very next chapter, which is, then David fled from Naoth in Ramah and came and said to Jonathan, which was in the city of Gibeah, quite a distance away from Ramah, what have I done? What is my iniquity? What is my sin before your father that he is seeking my life? Now, I want to read on from there. We're going to cover several verses today. But the first thing I wanted to ask before we get into the rest of the account now of chapter 20 and where that develops on from this point is what's happened between chapter 19, verse 24 and chapter 20, verse 1. What happened in the circumstance that has now caused David to leave the home of Samuel in Ramah and flee to Gibeah and seek out Jonathan, who is the son of Saul, and begin to pose these pressing questions upon Jonathan? What's going on here? What's taking place? Well, Saul does know where he's at, but was that a problem for David? Because Saul is stripped naked, forced to the ground by the Spirit of God, completely under the control of God. Saul knows exactly where David's at, but is that a threat to David in the present circumstance? Yeah, maybe in David's heart and in David's mind. I think I'm going to tag on to you and say, absolutely, in David's mind, he's still in danger. The point I want to bring out from this, though, is that from everything that we see in the text, the Lord is completely in charge of the circumstance. And David, while he did have good reason to flee from his own home, which had been surrounded by the soldiers of Saul, and flee to Samuel the prophet in Ramah in order to seek the word of the Lord and to seek the will of the Lord from the prophet of God, there is no good reason for David to flee Samuel's home. We don't see in this passage between verse 24 and verse 1 of the next chapter any indication that the word of the Lord came to David saying, you know, flee to Gibeah. We don't see any indication that Samuel spoke on behalf of the Lord to David and encouraged him or urged him to leave. We don't see any hint that he even stopped to consider whether he should leave this circumstance. We just see him fleeing. And the implication of the description of him fleeing, it's not just that he left the home of Samuel, he fled. The imagery kind of carries with it the sense of he's fleeing for his life still. Yes. Oh, yeah, he absolutely knows that Saul is chasing after him. There's no question about that. It's possible, but the indication here in terms of what I see is that where are you going to go that's better than in the home of the number one prophet on the face of the earth at this time in history? Samuel is the one that has the clearest and closest connection to the Lord. David did flee there and use wisdom in going to Samuel's house. And when he was there, what happened was, even though Saul continued to pursue him right to that spot, the miraculous hand of God was clearly protecting David. Saul and his soldiers could do nothing to reach David in that circumstance. And yet David is not, at this point, fully taking into account the miraculous, powerful hand of God. And now he continues in this process of fleeing. And all I see in this is that there's still a mixture going on here for David. In that we've already seen, David is a man of faith. There's no question about that. He's a man of God. He loves God with all of his heart. He believes in God. He trusts in God. He leans on the Lord. We saw awesome display of his faith in the fight against, for instance, Goliath. Clear, pure, true faith that's being expressed through his life. But that doesn't mean that every single moment of David's life is a moment of pure faith. Just like, and the point here for us to gain some wisdom and some understanding from this, is that, you know, as we walk in our walk of faith with the Lord, we all experience a bit of this same mixture. Meaning, that I have moments when my faith is more solid and more, you know, strong as I'm holding on to the promises of God. And then I have other moments where in moments of weakness or in moments of fear or moments of great anxiety where I will, in a sense, take a step out of more of a natural, it makes sense for me to get out of this situation because Saul is right here, rather than I'm really wanting to hear from the Lord and not even take a step away from Samuel's house unless the Lord speaks clearly to me to do so. So in this case, what I think is happening is that David makes an unwise decision to flee from the house of Samuel. Now, that doesn't mean that the Lord abandons him at this point. The Lord's going to continue to move with him and work with him and deal with him and lead him and guide him. And we'll see that as these circumstances of this chapter unfold. Well, let's go on ahead and read. At least I'd like to read up until I think I'll read through the first 17 verses of chapter 20. And then we'll see how far we get through that portion for today. Then David fled from Naoth in Ramah and came and said to Jonathan, "What have I done? What is my iniquity? And what is my sin before your father that he is seeking my life?" He said to him, "Far from it. You shall not die. Behold, my father," and this is Jonathan speaking now, "behold, my father does nothing, either great or small, without disclosing it to me. So why should my father hide this thing from me? Is it not so?" Yet David vowed again, saying, "Your father knows well that I have found favor in your sight. And he has said, 'Do not let Jonathan know this, or he will be grieved.' But truly as the Lord lives, and as your soul lives, there is hardly a step between me and death." Then Jonathan said to David, "Whatever you say, I will do for you." So David said to Jonathan, "Behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I ought to sit down and eat with the king. But let me go, that I may hide myself in the field until the third evening. If your father misses me at all, then say, 'David earnestly asked leave of me to run to Bethlehem, his city, because it is the yearly sacrifice there for the whole family.' If he says, 'It is good,' your servant will be safe. But if he is very angry, know that he has decided on evil. Therefore, deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. But if there is iniquity in me, put me to death yourself, for why then should you bring me to your father?" Jonathan said, "Far be it from you, for I should indeed learn that evil has been if I should indeed learn that evil has been decided by my father to come upon you, then would I not tell you about it?" Then David said to Jonathan, "Who will tell me if your father answers you harshly?" And Jonathan said to David, "Come and let us go out into the field." So both of them went out into the field. And then Jonathan said to David, "The Lord, the God of Israel, be witness. When I have sounded out my father about this time tomorrow or the third day, behold, if there is good feeling toward David, shall I not then send to you and make it known to you? If it please my father to do you harm, may the Lord do so to Jonathan and more also, if I do not make it known to you and send you away, that you may go in safety. And may the Lord be with you as he has been with my father. If I am still alive, will you not show me the loving kindness of the Lord, that I may not die? You shall not cut off your loving kindness from my house forever, not even when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth." So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "May the Lord require it at the hands of David's enemies." And Jonathan made David vow again because of his love for him, because he loved him as he loved his own life. All right. Well, the first thing here is that, of course, David has fled the house of Samuel in Ramah, and he's fled to Gibeah, which is where the king's house was. And, of course, Jonathan, who was his best friend in life, a true spiritual friend, a friend that the Lord had connected his life with, happened, of course, to be the son of the king. And so in order to find his best friend, he goes to Gibeah, even though going to Gibeah represents its own threat, because Gibeah is the house of Saul. So Saul, he's left Saul laying on the ground naked, prophesying in Ramah, and he's fled away from Saul to the house of Saul. And where's Saul going to tend to go after he finally gets up from his circumstance? He's going to go home, most likely. And so even though David is fleeing directly from Saul, it's kind of like he's fleeing circumstantially from the frying pan into the fire. And so he arrives in Gibeah. He arrives where Jonathan is, and he meets with Jonathan. And his greeting is a little bit abrupt. These are two deep and close friends, and here's how their greeting unfolds. What have I done? What is my iniquity and what is my sin before your father that he wants to kill me? Now, is that the way two really close friends greet each other after they haven't seen each other for a while? No. No, you don't. There's no polite, you know, greeting here. There's no, Jonathan, I miss seeing you. As soon as he sees Jonathan, he's immediately grilling Jonathan, putting him under the third degree. And why is that? What's happening here is that Jonathan and David had previously made an agreement and a promise to each other. It was a serious agreement and promise, one that we call a covenant agreement. They had established a covenant relationship with each other, and in that covenant relationship, they had made certain promises and certain assurances to each other. The basic, boiled down to our common way of describing it, they had promised that I'll watch your back if you'll watch my back. I won't ever stab you in the back. You can trust that you won't ever be stabbed in the back by me, and I won't stab you in the back. So what's going on here is that David arrives to his friend Jonathan and he begins to immediately grill him, because why? He is in fear of his life, but there's something more going on here. David suspects that Jonathan has not been true to their covenant. He is questioning whether Jonathan has kept his promise to him, because one of the promises that Jonathan made was that he would give him warning if Saul was pursuing or seeking his life. And here he had fled to Ramah and had to leave his own home, and he got neither warning from Jonathan about the soldiers that surrounded his home and forced him to leave his own home for his own safety, and he got no advance warning from Jonathan about the soldiers coming to Ramah and even Saul himself coming to Ramah. He had expected or hoped, at the very least, that Jonathan would send some messenger ahead, or Jonathan himself would come and warn him in advance. You need to leave your home tonight. My dad is coming. You need to leave Samuel's house. My father is coming. He doesn't receive any of those kind of warnings. So he's wondering and questioning whether his true blue friend has really been true and blue to him. And so he immediately begins to grill Jonathan, puts him on the spot. And he asks some basic and logical questions. There's nothing inherently wrong with the questions he asks. You know, when you're under attack, there's a natural tendency to want answers as to why this is happening. Of course, you know, there's a bigger picture going on here, which is what the Lord is doing. And what is obvious, or should be obvious to us, is that David, in this grilling of Jonathan, never once mentions the name of the Lord. Doesn't bring in even the consideration of what the Lord might be doing in this circumstance. At this moment, he's still struggling in his fears and in his anxieties, and he's dealing with the difficulty to test in a purely horizontal mode. He asks, what have I done? And what's the answer to that question? In other words, what he's looking for is, what have I done that would deserve being treated by Saul, and maybe even Jonathan being treated by you in this way for not having warned me? What have I done? So what's the correct answer to that question that he asked. What had he done to deserve it? Nothing. He had done nothing at all. The biggest test that you'll ever face in your Christian life is being attacked for something that you didn't do wrong. I mean, you know how it is. There are things we all do wrong. There are things that we do that are just not right in the eyes of the Lord, not right toward other people, and we get responses and reactions back from them that are appropriate disciplines of the Lord for our life, because we deserve to be disciplined. Like when I was growing up, you know, I grew up in the area where it was still expected to get a swat or two or a few from my father if I had done something wrong. I don't ever remember getting swatted for not deserving something. Every time I got swatted, I absolutely deserved it, and I needed to get swatted, okay? But the bigger test would be if you were being swatted and you had done nothing to deserve that swat, and how your heart deals with that, how your heart handles that. So his first question is, what have I done? What is my iniquity? What's the appropriate answer to that? There was no iniquity that he had done to deserve this attack by Saul. That's the question. And the possible betrayal of Jonathan, because at this point he doesn't quite know where Jonathan stands. So what have I done? Nothing. What's my iniquity? No sin whatsoever. I mean, yes, is David a sinner? Yes, of course. Has he done any sin deserving of the king of Israel trying to execute him? Absolutely not. He's been faithful to the Lord. He's been faithful to the king. He's been faithful to the nation. And he has actually been a great servant to all three. He does not deserve this particular treatment. There is no sin that has caused this. And then that's where the third question ends up. And what is my sin before your father that he is seeking my life? Meaning, what specifically have I ever done to your father that would cause him to treat me this way and continually treat me this way? Now, Jonathan doesn't answer those questions directly. He doesn't, you know, go one by one through those questions. What he does is with a single phrase, he gives David a clear understanding of how Jonathan is looking at this situation. That single phrase is, far from it, you shall not die. What he means by that, far from it, is, no, you're far from the truth. You have not sinned, as far as I can see. You don't deserve this, as far as I can see. You have never done wrong to my father that would have caused his reaction of wanting to kill you. It's an undeserved, unprovoked attack. Far from it that would happen. And he tries to encourage David's heart with this statement of, you shall not die. Now, of course, Jonathan's not ultimately in control of this. Saul is much more in control of it than Jonathan is, and above Saul, of course, is the Lord. But that's his heart, meaning I don't believe, David, that you deserve to die. I can't believe, in the essence of what he's saying, that the Lord will cause you to die in this circumstance. And he goes on to say, behold, my father does nothing, this is Jonathan speaking, my father does nothing, either great or small, without disclosing it to me. So why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so. Now, what is not so? When Jonathan says, it is not so, what is not so? Right. What he's basically saying to David is, David, you're exaggerating. You know, he's not necessarily accusing David of lying. He's just trying to tell David, you're reading this whole circumstance wrong. It's not so. And what is Jonathan basing that discernment on, that conclusion on? He's basing it on what he knows about his own relationship with his father. And what he's leaning on is this. In times past, my father has leaned on me as a trusted counselor. And whenever he's planning to do something, he's always told me about it before now. Therefore, if he's going to try to kill you, certainly my dad would tell me that he's going to try to kill you before he does it. Since he didn't tell me, it must not be that he's actually out there seeking your life. In other words, at this point, Jonathan is struggling to believe that his father could have fallen to the depths that he's actually fallen. He wants to believe the best of his own father. Now, he has some evidence already that things are not quite the way they should be. And is Jonathan's evaluation a true discernment? And the answer is no, it's not a true discernment. Jonathan, at this point, is seeing the circumstance through what we call rose-colored glasses. He's coloring the circumstance more favorably than it actually is. He's struggling to see just how dark and how far his dad has already digressed away from the Lord. Now, what's the evidence of that? Turn back to chapter 19 for just a moment. Verse 1, which we've already studied through, but I want to connect these two events. 19 verse 1 says, "Now Saul told Jonathan his son and all his servants to put David to death. But Jonathan, Saul's son, greatly delighted in David," and it goes on to describe how Jonathan, remember we studied this, where Jonathan made a godly appeal to his father and literally talked his father out of executing David, or attempting to. But what should Jonathan have learned from that? My dad really, really has it in for David. And he shouldn't have just, you know, he shouldn't have just cataloged that as, oh, this was just a bad day that my dad had. He got upset and mad at David, and it'll all blow over. Everything will go back to normal. Everything will be fine from this point forward. He should have recognized the depth of what had happened to Saul in his drifting away from the Lord. And in that, he should have been a little bit more ready to believe the testimony of David against his own inclination to believe the best of his own father. Because he had heard with his own ears his dad say, "I want you to kill David." Now, I mean, there's not much stronger evidence you need than that, other than to see his own dad trying to pin David to the wall with the spear like he had done two previous times to that even. So going back to chapter 20, even though Jonathan is hesitant to believe the testimony of David, David really understands that Jonathan, "I've got to convince Jonathan. I've got to get this across to him." Because David knows. David's not looking at this through rose-colored glasses. He knows just how much Saul really has it in for him. And it says that, "Yet David bowed again, saying, 'Your father knows well that I found favor in your sight. And he has said, do not let Jonathan know this, or he will be grieved. But truly, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there's hardly a step between me and death.'" All right, a couple of things are going on here. One is, what David does is he provides for Jonathan a logical and rational and accurate picture of why it is that Jonathan's discernment is faulty. Jonathan is basing his conclusion on the idea that, look, I've got such a close relationship with my dad, he would never do something like that without telling me first. And David is wanting him to see, no, in this case, he actually would do it without telling you first, and there's a reason why. And what was that reason? Your dad knows that you're closer to me than you are to him. And so he would hide this from you if he really does desire to kill me. And he would not tell you because he knows you would tend to step in the middle and try and stop that. Just like what happened in chapter 19 when Saul tried to order the death of David and Jonathan steps in between and appeals and stops that process from happening. David is saying, that's exactly what your father is doing. He doesn't want to tell you because in this circumstance, if he does, he knows you'll try to stop it. And then he goes on from there to describe his own perspective about his circumstance, which is he calls on the name of the Lord. This is why it's called a vow in verse 3, at the beginning of verse 3. He calls on the name of the Lord to, in a sense, confirm the truth of what he's describing. He's not just saying, it's kind of like we do in our justice system when we have someone come up to the witness stand and we have them say a vow before they take the stand. Are you vowing to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? And the whole idea there is that we are putting them in a position where we are are making sure they understand the formality and the seriousness of their words. And so what David is doing here is he's saying to Jonathan, look, I'm telling you in the most powerful way that I can tell you that I believe my life is at stake in this circumstance. And then he makes this last statement, and I think it's important for us to evaluate the implications of it. He says, as truly as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is hardly a step between me and death. Now, how does that description influence or affect our perspective of what's going on in David's heart and mind at this point? It's like we would say, I was an inch away from death. I'm a hair breadth away from death. First of all, is that true? Okay, I would argue and say it's both true and not true, depending upon which perspective you're looking at it. From a natural perspective, it's absolutely true. From a physical, pure physical perspective, it is 100% true. He had his house surrounded by soldiers that were under orders to execute him. He had three waves of soldiers follow him down to Ramah. He had Saul, the king, come himself with the intention of killing him. He's had two previous examples or circumstances in which Saul personally tried to pin him to the wall with a spear, as we saw. He's got plenty of evidence to show how close he is, one step away from death on a natural level. But on another level, how true is it? Is he spiritually in the greater sense of where the Lord is in this circumstance? Is he a hair breadth away from dying? The answer is no. He's got years ahead of him. And he is, as you've heard me describe in other contexts, he is at this moment in his life, whether he feels it or not, whether he can fully believe it and embrace it or not, he's invulnerable. He's invulnerable, like Superman. You know, that's the great thing about Superman. Other than kryptonite, you know, you can shoot him with bullets, you can hit him with ray guns, you can, you know, run a tank over him, and he just gets up and dusts his blue uniform off and you know, goes ahead and defeats the bad guys. You can't hurt Superman. Now, I'm not saying that David is in his own self and in his own strength a Superman. I'm saying that because of God's calling and purpose upon his life, in which God has said, David, and God said this through Samuel the prophet. It was a true word of God. It wasn't just a, you know, when there's a prophecy of a calling upon a person's life and a future purpose that God is going to bring about. It's not just God is making educated guesses about what he hopes might or should happen in the future. And, you know, what actually happens is a little bit beyond God's control. You know, it's just God is showing what, in the best case scenario, he would like to see happen when there's a prophecy. It's not like that at all. When Samuel, at the beginning of our study of the life of David, came to the house of David and took that horn of oil and emptied it on David's head and proclaimed that this is the chosen one of God who will one day be the king of Israel, what that did was that made David invulnerable until the Lord's purpose for his life is finished or complete. David will be the king. And I don't care what Saul tries to do to frustrate or end that purpose of God. Saul is not going to be able to kill David. And we're going to see as we go on through the life of David, there's going to be many more attempts. You know, this isn't the end of the attacks of Saul. This is just the beginning. He's going to go through years of these kinds of circumstances that he has to deal with, in which his calling is being challenged. But he is invulnerable because he's under the hand and calling and purpose of God. Until the calling of God for his life is finished and is complete. And it's not going to be David that's going to die. It's going to be Saul that's going to die. And it's not David that's not going to fulfill his calling. It's going to be Saul that won't fulfill his calling. So what I'm saying is, connecting this with where we ended at the end of chapter 19, David didn't need to flee from the house of Samuel at all. He was invulnerable in the blessing and under the hand of God. But we don't always see that perfectly when we're under the fire and when we're the target and when the spear of the enemy of God is aimed directly at our heart. You know, there's sometimes we get a little bit nervous when that spear is pointed at us. Even though our deepest and greatest faith is, Lord, I know my life is in your hands. Nevertheless, when that spear is heading our way, there's a lot of, you know, natural tendency to flee and head the other direction as quickly as possible. So he says there's hardly a step between me and death. It's not entirely true. Physically, naturally, yes. In the bigger picture, there's many steps. Many, many, many steps between him and death. And those steps are every step that's ahead of him for the rest of his many years to come in the Lord. Many steps between him and death. Then Jonathan said to David, whatever you say, I will do for you. Meaning that Jonathan is impacted by the words that David has spoken. And Jonathan gets it by the hand of God, by the grace of God. He sees that what David is saying about his father, what David is saying about his circumstance is true. And so he doesn't argue any further with David at this point. He immediately moves from this point forward through the rest of the chapter. Jonathan moves into true friend mode, meaning that he is a friend of David's. We talked before when we studied through the development, the early development of the friendship between Jonathan to David, that there is a great value to this kind of friendship. What I called then a special kind of friendship. I described it as covenant friendship. There's a great value to this. And as soon as Jonathan recognizes that his real covenant friend is in real danger, he immediately just shifts gears in his heart. He's no longer defending his father. He's no longer trying to deny the reality of what David is saying. He just gets it. He sees it. And his first response is the response of a true friend. You know, a friend in need, you know, as a friend indeed, as the old saying in our culture goes. The Bible phrases it a little bit different way. Turn for a moment. We'll come right back to Samuel. Turn to the book of Proverbs for a second, chapter 17. I'll read just a single verse from verse 17:17. Says a friend, and of course the presumption here is a true friend, a friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. Meaning that there are certain special relationships in the course of your life that the Lord brings you into that will be there for you through thick and thin, and when you most need that relationship. Now, I encouraged you when we were studying through the covenant friendship being formed between David and Jonathan to ask the Lord to identify such relationships in your life. And you may already have such a friendship, or you may never have yet experienced that depth, that quality of a friendship. But it is something to be highly prized and highly valued. There are few things as valuable in your life as a true covenant level friend. A friend that will be there to support you and be there for you when you most need it. And David was in one of those circumstances where he most needed it. And Jonathan's response wasn't, you know, David, you must have done something wrong. David, this must be your fault. His response is simply, whatever you say, I will do it for you. Now, what that reminds me of a little bit, and of course, you know, this comparison is even greater because I've been talking just about, on a horizontal level, the true friendships that the Lord connects us to, the true spiritual relationships that the Lord makes in our lives for His greater purpose. And that's, by the way, the exceptional quality of a covenant friendship, is that a covenant friendship is not just based on things like, you know, we go to baseball games together and that's what makes us close friends, or we like the same kind of music, or you know, we both like fast cars or something like that. A true covenant friendship is based upon a common purpose in the Lord, understanding that God has linked our lives together for His greater kingdom purpose. So in that, we've been mostly focused on those horizontal relationships. But the greatest friend, and, you know, this is old Christian terminology, but it's good Christian terminology. The greatest friend you'll ever have in your life is, oh, what a friend we have in Jesus, you know. And that is, I mean, it's kind of become a trite saying among Christians, but it's an absolutely true saying. The one friend that will never, ever, ever stab you in the back. The one friend that will never, ever, ever fail to be there for you when you most need him is Jesus. And when Jonathan speaks the words of a true friend, it reminds me of when Jesus says to his disciples, whatever you ask in my name, I will do it for you. Meaning that I will be your true supportive friend through all of your life circumstances. I don't care what you go through. I don't care what you face. I don't care what you are called upon to endure. I will be there in the midst of that circumstance right alongside you to support you, to uphold you, to strengthen you, to encourage you, to pour into you everything that you desperately need to make it through that circumstance. And Jonathan, I believe, represents the Lord here for David in that way. You know, sometimes we're in such a great place spiritually that we can receive all of that just directly from the Lord. But then there are times, like David's clearly struggling with fear and anxiety here. There are times that we need the Lord to bring someone on a horizontal level alongside of us to provide that sense of the Lord's support. Because that's what Jonathan is doing here. The only reason Jonathan could be such a true friend to David is because of Jonathan's own relationship with the Lord. Saul is certainly not David's true friend. And why? Because Saul is drifted far from the Lord. It's only those who are connected together in the same kind of quality and close relationship with the Lord that can provide this kind of true supportive friendship for one another. All right. I think I will stop right at that point. We've got a lot left to cover in this chapter, but I think that those points that we've covered so far are well worth just stopping and chewing on and letting them settle in. And Lord willing, we will pick up next month, same place and time, and we'll continue to unfold chapter 20 together. All right?